Well, thanks. Good morning. I'd like to thank the speakers for the opportunity to be here and the opportunity to tell you about a quantum Monte Carlo method that we've been working on to try to study more realistic systems. And this takes the form of a Slater determinant space random walk. Here's an outline of the talk. First, I'll give you a very brief introduction to quantum Monte Carlo methods. It'll be very brief, hopefully, though it'll put this next part in context. It'll also help, hopefully, illustrate why we're trying to formulate this approach, which is, as I mentioned, a random walk method, but in Slater determinant space as a ground state method. And then I'll try to say more explicitly why we wanted to look at this. And for people who are familiar with doing quantum Monte Carlo, you'll realize that whether you do this in a Slater determinant space or real space or whatever other space, you're going to run into some form of a sign problem for fermions. In this case, it's even worse than that. You run into a phase problem. So I'm going to talk about the phase problem. But if you are not familiar with it, hopefully this part will sort of give you an idea of why it happens and then what we do to deal with it, which is an approximate solution. So this is the sort of the key part of the talk, the technical part. And then I'll show you the first application of this formalism to silicon. We do calculations on the silicon atom and dimer, and then bulk up to 54 atoms in a FCC supercell. The binding energy of silicon 2 molecule and the cohesive energy of the bulk both come out to be in excellent agreement with the experimental values. And then we'll summarize and more discussions. So here's the very brief introduction to quantum Monte Carlo methods. We're going to focus on ground state methods, although finite temperature algorithms do exist. But for ground state, we want to project out the many-body ground state wave function in some basis for a particular many-body Hamiltonian, which we know, which is H. All quantum Monte Carlo algorithms start, their starting point is basically this line here. They start from some arbitrary initial function. The only requirement on this is that it has a non-vanishing overlap with the ground state one is seeking. And this is the many-body Hamiltonian, and tau is a small positive constant. So one basically takes the initial wave function and repeatedly applies e to the minus tau h, this projector, onto that wave function as an iteration. Asymptotically, this iteration will lead to the ground state. This is, there's nothing here about quantum Monte Carlo. For example, Lanczos basically is based on the same idea, the so-called power method to damp out the excited states. So the difference in methods, the reason one wants to use stochastic Monte Carlo methods is because this is explicitly very hard to do, very expensive. That's why Lanczos exact diagonalization is limited to small systems. So the difference in quantum Monte Carlo methods lies in the different ways of realizing this iteration stochastically. And I'm going to mention two approaches, diffusion Monte Carlo and auxiliary field methods. So the first of these is diffusion Monte Carlo. And this is the this has been the dominant sort of approach in electronic structure calculations by quantum Monte Carlo. There's a nice review article fairly recently. And some of you have heard talks during this workshop. So this is only a very brief summary. I won't go into any of the details here. So the method works in real space, in coordinate space, where the space is many-dimensional, R, I labeled, which contains all the electronic coordinates, right? So if you have n electrons, then this is a 3n dimensional space, typically. What I want you to remember about the technical detail of this is just this picture here. So for schematically, for many, so this is the high dimensional R space. the wave function, the fermion wave function, has this shape here where there's some sort of a node. This is not a point, it's a many-dimensional space here, but it vanishes at some point. So this is a function you want to represent. In diffusion Monte Carlo, so psi, any function, and in this case we're interested in the ground state wave function, is equal to the sum of the ground state wave function amplitude psi of r and then the basis, and in this case it's real space. So basically in this many-dimensional space you have a functional form, and you want to represent it by some sort of stochastic sampling. The idea of that is just the same as sampling a Gaussian in 1D. So this little curve here is a Gaussian. And the way you do that is you call a random number generator and you do something to the random numbers. They come out to be distributed like a Gaussian. So in that case, the Gaussian can be thought of as Monte Carlo representation of the Gaussian as a sum over all these red dots. So the red dots represent these samples that you draw to represent a particular function. So anytime you do a Monte Carlo sampling of a function, you can think of, and this is approximate, of course, and it gets more and more accurate as you draw more and more of these red dots. But the function you're trying to represent is a sum over all these dots. Or more rigorously, you should write this as a delta function distributed at these positions, Monte Carlo samples. So that's what I want you to remember about this scheme, is that it's a many-dimensional wave function, but the outcome of diffusion Monte Carlo is that you have a representation of this wave function, which is just a sequence of samples. These are positions in this three-dimensional space, and their distribution represents the wave function. Another point here is fermion wave function is anti-symmetric, so it has a node. So somewhere it goes to zero. This position is not known. So you do the fixed node approximation. And that's, if you don't do that, you run into a sign problem where the distribution wants to collapse to a boson state. But this is the picture where the wave function is given only in the sense of a collection of samples. Okay, and these samples are three-dimensional points, so snapshots of the system. Okay, so this has been applied. Obviously, there are lots of technical details to make this much more efficient, but this is the key point. This has been applied to atoms, molecules, clusters, solids, and it has had a great deal of success, as you see from the review article and the talks. So it's a very promising approach. The issues with it, first issue, which is partially solved by using the fixed node approximation, is the fermion sign problem. So this introduces an approximation, while for boson systems, this random walk approach is basically exact. So and then efficiency issue, human, for example, to optimize trial wave functions. You want to optimize the trial wave function, which normally serves as the starting point of the random walk, but you also use it in playing all these tricks to make the method go. You need to optimize this to make a good starting point for the method to be efficient. And obviously, you'd like the calculation to go faster to be able to treat bigger systems, but trial wave function optimization is a key because we would like to go to strongly correlated systems, and in some of these systems, we don't even know what's the right form. And in addition to that, we have to optimize the parameters to make the wave function sort of close enough for the algorithms to go. And so this is a main issue. And then accurate calculations of observables. For example, one would like to be able to calculate nuclear forces or correlation functions. This is hard because of this picture. You have the wave function only in the sense of a bunch of samples, discrete points. And in order to calculate an observable, you want psi squared, you want psi times psi. If you have two sets of delta functions, the overlap is ill-defined, right? So it's actually, if you want, for the energy, it turns out there's a trick. You could use only one set of samples and then a trial wave function, that turns out to be exact. But for correlation functions, you need two sets of wave functions. You need two wave functions on the left and on the right to make an expectation value, and both of these are represented by a sum of delta functions, or r's. When you take the overlap, very often the overlap is zero. So yeah, you have to play a game, it's called a mixed estimate, which is, again, approximate, which relies on the quality of the trial wave function. And then to go to large systems, for example, all electron calculations, diffusion Monte Carlo calculations, are basically limited to the first row. To go to bigger systems, you want to treat co-electrons. And the way it's being treated is to use pseudopotentials. But there is a technical difficulty with diffusion Monte Carlo in treating non-local pseudopotentials, where one has to make what's called the locality approximation. This approximation, the quality of this approximation, depends on the quality of the wave function, the trial wave function one uses, not just the nodal position, which is up to this point the only thing that determines the outcome, the systematic error. If you guess the nodal position, many-body wave function nodal position right, you are in principle going to have the exact answer. The error bars will depend on the quality of the trial wave function. So that's a very nice property. But with this, with non-local pseudopotentials, the quality of the calculation depends not only on the nodal position, but on the overall quality of the wave function. Okay, so that's why you have to, coming back here, you have to work hard to optimize the trial wave function. So it's a technical issue, but it's an important technical issue to separate the energy scales. And the applications of this method, quantum Monte Carlo method, to strongly correlated systems are not yet widespread. So I'll mention even more briefly the standard auxiliary field, quantum Monte Carlo. This is not new to here. It's actually invented here at UCSB. The formalism I'll talk about in formulating the random walk, determinant random walk, will be closely related to this. So there'll be more to come. But it's being applied mainly to correlated electron lattice models, to nuclear shell models, et cetera. And a lot of you are familiar with QMC in the context of the impurity solver, QMC impurity solver for DMFT, and that's very closely related. The issues, how do you go beyond simple Hubbard, beyond sort of near on-site or near-neighbor interactions? How do you go to more extended systems, both as a paradigm for the physics, you know, to extend, to become more realistic, and also just a method to do calculation? How do you treat more extended interactions? And there's a sign problem, and it shares some of the other issues I discussed with diffusion Monte Carlo. So one would like to improve the method. So now I'm going to shift gear and talk about Slater determinant random walks, how we formulate this. So for any one particle basis, the Hamiltonian, if it consists of one body, you know, any sort of potential, and then two body interactions, can be written in this form, in second quantized form, where H1 is some sort of a, for example, the kinetic energy or external potential, and then this denotes the interaction, electron-electron interaction, for example, the interaction term. It has four of these C's.
These are side indices or what?
These are basis indices. So you could choose to work in real space, then these will be sites. But you could work, the examples I'll show are in plane wave basis, then these label plane waves. Okay. So in any basis, you could write this in this form, where the green stuff has two C's. So that I'm going to call a one-body operator, a general one-body operator. And that's friendly in this form, because one-body operators, for example, from DFT or Hartree-Fock calculations, we know how to treat these. This is a two-body operator. That's the hard part. This is the key. This is going to be linearized, decoupled, using the Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation, where you want to write this 4C object as a sum over terms of the form V squared, where little v is of this form. It's a one-body form. So this is going to be written as a sum. The price you pay is you might have to sum over lots of terms. But it's always possible to write a term like this into a sum over v squared, where v is a one-body term.
What about the sign? I mean, why should all these v squared have the...
That's right. So I didn't say what v could be complex.
Oh, okay.
Right, and that's the key issue. So through the Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation, what we want is then to write e to the minus tau h, remember this is the projector you want to apply to your initial wave function, as a sum over fields, and this is just a Gaussian distribution in many dimensions, and then a propagator b sigma, where b has the form of, b is a function of these sigmas, auxiliary fields, and then it has the form of exponential minus tau H1 over 2, you know where this came from, it's just that first term, exponential of the first term, and I divided it by 2 to symmetrize it here. But it's just all the mean field, all the one-body terms go there. And this middle term comes from this two-body interaction. And see, now it's written, it's linear in V, where V denotes the collection of these V sigma, V gammas, right? So V is just a vector form of these operators. So, but it's the key is after this, it's linear in V, and that's because you, when you complete the square, you can get V squared back out. Okay, and I just want to illustrate this, make this maybe a little bit more concrete, with sort of an example for something like Jellium, and this is straight out of a many-body textbook. But if you don't want to sort of deal with it this early in the morning, that's fine. You just remember that the bottom line is we want to write this. In a square form, okay? For electronic system, the Hamiltonian is kinetic term, and then the electron-ion interaction term, and then the electron-electron interaction term, and then some constant, which represents ion-ion interactions, for example. So this is the many-body Hamiltonian, and if you choose a plane wave basis, which I label K, K labels G of K. So these are plane wave vectors. So think of a periodic system for now. Then K is a good operator, it's one body, as is VEI, electron ion. It has the form given there. It has can have a local form, which depends on the difference between two plane wave vectors and CI, BAG, or CJ. And then a non-local form, which comes in when you deal with non-local pseudopotentials. But the key is, again, it's CI, BAG, or CJ, except this is more complicated. It depends on the wave vectors. So this is a green term. And then the electron-electron interaction, it's just 1 over r. But now in plane wave basis, it's written in this form of ij sum over these. There's some collapse, some simplification, so it's not ijkl anymore. See, this is I and I plus some q, and then this is j, j minus q. Okay, so this is your familiar with. But this, for example, then you can write as rho dagger times rho, where rho is just a sum of this grouped with that. Of course, when I commute through one of these, any one-body terms, I just absorb them back into the green. Okay, so this is rho dagger rho. And then I can manipulate that into squares. Okay. So it's rho dagger plus rho squared, and then rho dagger minus rho squared. And Antoine's question, you see the signs here could be different, and so if necessary, you put an I in there to make it a square. So back to here, the bottom line is for any interaction, in any basis, I can write it in this form. The maximum number of terms I would have to have here is n squared, okay? If I'm willing to deal with complex numbers, the maximum number of terms is n squared, where n is the size of the basis. So with the Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation, we have this form of a Gaussian times a one-body propagator. So physically, this says that the many-body propagator can be expressed as a sum over single one-electron propagators. And the sum, these one-electron propagators depend on some external fields, and the external fields fluctuate. So it's sort of the idea of CI, where you deal with independent electron systems, and you sum over enough of these for a given configuration or a given prescription of the external fields. If you sum them over systematically, then you recover the many-body correlation. Okay. So this is the projector we have, and we want to apply it to some initial wave function. So the random walk in Slater determinant space then is the following. Again, this is you start from some initial wave function, and you want to apply e to the minus tau h1s. You get to the first stage, and you repeat this. Eventually, this is supposed to be the ground state wave function, right? So this is the starting point. And now we're going to turn this process into a random walk. The way we do that is this is the initial wave function. We're going to assume that it's a it's a Slater determinant. So for example, it could be the LDA solution, could be Hartree-Fock, but in any case, we can write it as a single Slater determinant. We're going to create a whole bunch of single Slater determinants, and for lack of a better choice, we could just make them all equal, and they're all the LDA solutions. Yes?
Sure. This zero field V, right, it always fluctuates in space.
Mm-hmm.
Does it also fluctuate in time?
Yes.
Okay, so it's time becomes a time-dependent problem.
That's right.
Right?
Imaginary time-dependent, yeah.
Yeah, so then the sweater determinant, I mean, I used to think of a sweater determinant as a solution of stationary problem,
mm-hmm.
stationary Schrödinger equation, time-independent. But if potential is time-dependent, then what does it mean, sweater determinant?
At every step you have in this projection, right, starting from here, every step in the projection, you have an anti-symmetric wave function, which then can be represented as a sum of Slater determinants.
But the wave function, is it time-dependent?
That's right. This wave function will start from the LDA solution. If you look at the energy of that wave function, it'll come down, it'll approach the many-body ground state. So that's time-dependent, imaginary time, not real time. And every stage, horizontally, right, you make a cut. Every stage, the wave function can be represented by a sum over Slater determinants. So that's, in fact, that's what this is, right? So the first stage, you start with a bunch of Slater determinants that are, let's say, LDA solutions, and then you're supposed to do something. You're supposed to propagate them, and then they get to the first stage, right, phi 1. And this collection now will be different from that collection, and furthermore, these different phi 1s will be different from each other. Right? So the way you get from here to there is you're supposed to apply that, and we've just written this out as a sum over mean field propagators. So then it's straightforward by Monte Carlo. You sample a sigma from the Gaussian, right? Sigma is a many-dimensional vector, could be, as we say, as large as n squared. But whatever it is, we could sample a many-dimensional Gaussian. Once you do that, you determine sigma, and then you've determined this B, non-interacting propagator, right? Then the problem becomes operating B on a Slater determinant. That we already know how to do. We do that in LDA, we do that in Hartree-Fock. It's a non-interacting, it's a one-electron problem. So you apply B to phi zero to propagate it by one step, and that goes to phi one. You repeat this for the rest of the population. Of course, you get different sigmas, so they deviate from each other. And then you just keep going, repeat the same process. Okay.
You normalize at each stage because imaginary time evolution does not preserve the normalization.
That's right. So we don't normalize at every step, but we normalize once in a while. By normalizing, we actually mean we re-orthogonalizing the different orbitals. As you apply B to phi, right? Phi could start with a bunch of orbitals that are orthogonal to each other and properly normalized. But if you apply this once, that property is ruined. So once in a while, we take the orbitals and we orthogonalize them and we normalize them.
The number of walkers is fixed?
No, because of this normalization, the number of walkers will fluctuate because some of them, when you renormalize the orbitals, will come out to have a big weight. Some will have a smaller weight, and the sum of weights will fluctuate. So the number of walkers will change. So this is a very simple-minded picture. In reality, what happens is you're going to have branching. So this line, for example, can turn into two, and then this next one could die. It's a branching random walk, very much like in diffusion Monte Carlo. But the basic idea, again, I want to emphasize, is this procedure, except for the branching part, which we learn from quantum Monte Carlo, the basic idea of this propagation, we already know how to do. That's a one-electron problem. Right. So it's a combination of each step here. There's a Monte Carlo that samples this, and then you could do tricks to make it more efficient, to make important sampling and stuff, some of which I'll get into. But basically, this bearable, this propagation is a one electron. It's exactly the same as what you do in a one electron calculation.
Can you say again, what do you normalize? Because, I mean, you start with phi zeros, which are not necessarily, they could be all the same, right?
Phi zeros. Oh, sorry. I normalize each phi, not across different phis. So each phi has the form of, so let's say just phi 1 I, the ith random walker in here, and I labels one of these dots, let's say, has the form of this is bad notation. Where this is one entire orbital written in plane wave basis. So for example, psi 1 has the form of sum over these plane wave bases. So this is just a bunch of coefficients. That's the first orbital, and that's the second, and so on. This goes up to the number of electrons. So what I mean by normalizing is I normalize these coefficients to make a normalized orbital. And then as I propagate this, these orbitals will change, and they won't be orthogonal to each other. Then I, you know, do the usual thing that you do in one electron calculation. You orthogonalize them.
Sorry, so I'm confused. Tau is a small number, right?
Yes.
So why do I need to put in the Hilbert-Tetonovich? Which I mean, I can apply the exponential if tau is small, right?
The exponential, well, you need the Hilbert-Tetonovich to write this into a...
otherwise, I cannot apply it to another.
That's right. So, good, thanks. I forgot to say one important thing, which is the result of e to the minus tau, some sort of a H1, this propagator on a phi leads to another determinant. Right? So any one-body form of the general form of C1, CI, CJ, the application of this propagator, or more generally what I called B sigma there, B sigma on a phi leads to a determinant. But if you don't have this form, you're not guaranteed to have one Slater determinant anymore. So in principle, you could apply this directly. That's the same thing. You would lead to many determinants.
How many points, chi-zeros, do you usually need?
We typically do. It depends, because statistics is gained by, you know, once you've equilibrated, it's gained by summing over things vertically and horizontally. So depending on what we fit in memory, we could sort of play with it. But typically we do, you know, for these biggest calculations, we do hundreds of phis simultaneously. So this is the random walk. And again, the wave function, ground state wave function, is represented as a sum over these phis. So the after you converge, the ground state wave function is simply a sum over Slater determinant. Okay? Just like in diffusion Monte Carlo, where the sum is over an R in real space, this is over phi.
So is that something like a, say, iterated version of CI?
Basically, but CI, you keep these orbitals fixed, and then you excite things to higher orbitals, like these could be Hartree-Fock orbitals. We modify the orbitals stochastically. And I think that's a, there's a, well, I mean, you want to do things stochastically so that the scaling is good. If you do CI, you have to, I mean, you have to. So one advantage that you see is each walker here, what we call a walker here, is an anti-symmetric solution. It's a complete one electron wave function. So going back to this issue, why do we want to do this? Well, we would have a QMC approach that shares exactly the same machinery as in a mean field calculation, as in a Hartree-Fock or DFT calculation, using any one particle basis. The one particle problem would be solved exactly with no statistical fluctuation. If you work in real space, if you do diffusion Monte Carlo, for example, suppose we have a wonderful LDA calculation that's bam. We want to turn this method into one that just duplicates LDA with no statistical fluctuation, right? And this does that because the Hilbert-Tetonovich term would be zero, and you would not do anything. You would just repeat the mean field projection, okay? So for things that are, you know, where you can find a good mean field, I don't necessarily mean the traditional mean field, whatever basis you could find, right, where you could move most of the system to, you know, as a one body in a one electron form, you should take advantage of that. And this is one way to do that, by getting rid of Monte Carlo, getting rid of statistical fluctuations. And the correlation effects are then obtained by building stochastic ensembles of these independent particle solutions. So it's, I don't know, the picture is appealing that you could just do these independent electron calculations and put them together in a coherent way, and they recover these correlations systematically. Perhaps then there is a better opportunity to for making an approximation to treat the sine problem better than fixed node. And then each worker, as I mentioned just now, is a full mean field wave function. So if you want to calculate an expectation value, you don't have that problem of putting an R on R prime where the overlap would vanish because they're both one body, the full wave functions, right? And people who do QMC in the form of auxiliary fields know this, right? Correlation functions are routinely calculated. You just need the Green's functions, right? So perhaps we would be able to get out more useful information out of a QMC calculation.
Question?
Yeah.
So does this method work better and better as there is less and less correlation in your problem?
Yes. If you, so in the limit of, you know, where you could move everything into a 2C object, this will just be, you know, a one-shot calculation. It won't be a Monte Carlo calculation anymore. So, as I mentioned, the picture of this random walk is nice, but you run into a problem. You run into a sine problem. If these V's are real in this Hubbard-Stanovic transformation, if all the V's are real, then you run into a sine problem. What happens is, so this is sort of the abstract space of these determinants. And again, this is not even an orthogonal space. Right? But in this space, you want a sum over these determinants to represent an anisometric wave function, for example, your ground state wave function. But if you have a collection of phis that makes a good representation of the ground state wave function, I could just take every phi and put a minus sign in front. In other words, I exchange two of these orbitals that makes a minus sign. That's an equally good representation because it's just the many body ground state times with a minus sign. But in the random walk, of course, you don't know when you've swapped two columns because the columns continuously evolve. So in this sort of picture here, what you want for the ground state is a distribution that looks like that. Right, just one side, where this is zero. This means the overlap is measured by the exact wave function. Right? If you knew the exact wave function, the overlap with the exact wave function is positive. You only need one set of determinants. But as you so you can start here, as you start your random walk, it's a diffusion process. It's going to go over all space. You end up with a distribution that looks like the dashed line. Right? So eventually, if you wait long enough, you'll have an equal distribution of these minuses and pluses. Of course, then the signal, when you sum over all these phis, you get zero. Right? So that's the sine problem. The random walk leads to a mixture of these two ensembles. So the constraint path approximation, which we developed some years ago, imposes a simple constraint. It just says, we don't know the exact wave function, but we could come up with a trial wave function. And if the overlap in the random walk, if the overlap of a walker with this trial wave function is positive, then we keep it. But if it tries to cross this point, we throw it away, we kill it. Right? So it's analogous to fixed node, but it does this indeterminate space. Right? That turns out to work really well for lattice models. Right? For example, you could get better energies than configuration space fixed node over a fairly wide range of interactions for something like the Hubbard model. Okay.
Is it easy to see that this obeys detailed balance imposing the constraint?
Yes, you could do it in a way, because it's a diffusion process, you could show if it's, for example, if it's a one-dimensional diffusion, you have a Brownian particle in 1D, if you put a infinitely absorbing boundary here, or a hot wall here, sorry, then you could have an algorithm. I said you just kill it, but you kill it in a sort of a slightly more, I don't know, civilized way, where the distribution would reach equilibrium and the normalization would be preserved. Right? So, but in our case here, the problem is worse than that. V is complex in general. So except for attractive interactions or special cases like the Hubbard model where you have one on-site thing, you have the decomposition, the Hirsch decomposition, V is complex. So V gamma, which is, you know, we have these V gamma squared, has the form of I times these are real matrix elements, Ci dagger Cj. So then you not only do you have plus minus, you have phases, right, for overall phases for the Slater determinant. And you could argue, well, the final wave function for a system, for example, without magnetic field is real. So we could argue that we just want to keep, we do the same trick as in constrained path Monte Carlo. We take a phi, we take the overlap with some psi t, and if the real part of that is positive, we keep it. If it's negative, then we stop it. Right? So that's, in fact, the first thing we tried. But this turned out not to work well at all. So for example, this is a very simple system of gellium, two electrons, RS equal 10. So it's a periodic system. You put two electrons there. You could diagonalize this system exactly. And this is the correlation energy is measured by this projection, the random walk, as a function of projection time. So beta is n, the number of steps, times the time step. So this goes out to 50 or so. Right, so the exact result is supposed to be this. As you start from zero correlation, because we start from a non-interacting wave function, you carry out the projection, it's supposed to converge eventually to about 0.02. But if you put in this approximation, the simple constrained path, it comes down, see this dashed red line, and now basically this is good because nobody has crossed the node, right? So you're not doing anything. And then you start putting in this constraint, you see what happens. It has a slow increase, and this is real, actually. You could run it with better accuracy. But eventually it converges, but the answer is way off.
Why do you show this for R is equal to 10?
Because that's a more strongly interacting system. For weaker, like IS equal 4, I would get a very good curve. I wouldn't be able to make the case. So what we do then, so this is solution, how you deal with this problem, is it's a two-part solution. First part, we do an importance sampling transformation. The reason I put this in quote is because importance sampling, as we typically come across it, means you modify the probability in some way. But what I'm going to use as an importance function is a complex function. Right? So we want to do the Monte Carlo representation of the ground state wave function in a modified form. Remember, before we just have the ground state as a sum over phi, Slater determinants. Now I want to modify so that my Monte Carlo samples would represent things in this way, so that I have a Monte Carlo sample, I just divide it by that. So I'm allowed to do that, provided I put it back in the sampling process. The reason I want to do this is the contribution of each phi then would be independent of its phase if psi t is exact. Because when I measure its contribution, I take an overlap with psi t or psi 0. If I take an overlap with psi 0 and psi t is equal to psi 0, then I get 1. Everybody contributes 1. There's no phase. Right? I want to take the overall phase of the determinant out of this random sampling process. Because any approximation we make, if the phase is supposed to be there, then when you kill it, right? When you take the real part and then you if it's less than zero, you throw it away, you're going to make a mistake. But if the phase is not supposed to be there anymore in the final equation, then I'm free to do what I want with it. So that's sort of a simple-minded thing. So I want to represent the wave function this way. I can do that, and you see that this is going to be approximate because, you know, in practice, I don't have the exact wave function. But I modify the propagator accordingly. The reason I want to modify it is because I put in artificially this piece, which I want to take out in the sampling. Right? So for each phi going to some phi prime as a function of sigma, this is the random walk, I just modify the propagator. So now this is the previous propagator, Gaussian, and then the one-body piece. I divide it and multiply it. This is the usual trick of importance sampling to take out the factor. And it turns out, after some manipulations, you could reduce this to some very simple form, where this is the one-body piece before, and this is e to the sigma times square root tau v is the one-body form before. But now there is a new thing coming in, which is the green thing, sigma bar, which I call a shift. And then there is an extra piece, e to the minus tau e local, coming out. So this is all just standard. If you expand phi prime to order tau, you'd be able to arrive at this. So the shift is this form, which I can evaluate because I know the trial wave function, and the local energy I can also evaluate. And the reason I call them these names is because they parallel diffusion Monte Carlo. Okay. So the key thing here is this shift is complex. So it fundamentally modifies your random walk process because this is a complex number. That's real. That's a random variable. But this is a complex piece that puts in a damping term that changes the random walk path. In other words, it takes you to a different space. So this is key. If you any sort of a real shift would not do anything, you would get the same sort of constraint. So this is a key.
So this sigma bar is something you have to update at each point?
That's right. That's right. You have to, as the random walk evolves, you have to calculate it. So that's step A. It turns out that's still not enough. Even with A, this is what I'm showing, again, a two-electron problem. This is the imaginary part of the overlap of a walker with some psi t, and this is the real part of the overlap with psi t. And there's lots of colors here because they represent five different random walkers throughout the history of this random walk. They all start from here, which is one, because I take the psi t turns out to be just the mean field result. When they start, they are the mean field solution, so they overlap with my trial function is just one. And these different colors, again, there's five colors, they represent five different walkers, right? So they all start from one, and then they wander around. And this is a huge amount of time. This is like beta of 1,000 or something. This is the trajectory they make, okay? This is after the important sampling transformation, but I actually look at the walkers and I measure their overlap with the trial wave function. What you see out of this, well, it's very symmetric, right? That's not good because, for example, right at the origin, when phi is supposed to have no overlap with the trial wave function, you have a finite density there. That's a problem because, see, all of these, the local energy, for example, depends on the overlap with the trial wave function. If this is zero, which happens at the origin, then the whole thing blows up, right? And this shift blows up also. So then you have huge fluctuations. This is a problem because it's rotationally invariant. Again, going back to this phase problem, if you have a determinant, you can put any phase in there, it's still a good representation of the ground state wave function, right? And this is reflecting that you could rotate this in the phase plane any way you want. Putting any phase here, it's still a good member of some ensemble, right? So it's completely symmetric. What you want to do then is to break this rotational invariance. Now you're allowed to do that because of the important sampling we just did, because that took the phase out of the equation. The phase doesn't matter anymore. Then I could do this to it. I could constrain this to a one-dimensional walk. This is 2D. So all this is saying happens in high-dimensional space, but it's a trivial point that it's making. It says if you have a one-dimensional Brownian motion, you can put a barrier anywhere, and this is a sink. Then the Brownian motion will eventually trace out a distribution that vanishes at the barrier. But if it's a two-dimensional random walk, you have an origin, a single point that has an infinitely absorbing sink, and the Brownian motion would be freely diffusing in this plane. Even with the delta function sink at the origin, the density at the origin would be finite because it has no dimension, right? The delta function has no dimension. So the final distribution would still be a finite density at the origin. So 1D, if you put a barrier, that kills the entire distribution. It vanishes linearly at the barrier. 2D, if you put a single point, nothing happens. It doesn't notice the single point. So what I want to do is to turn this into a one-dimensional random walk. I do that by every time the walker goes off the axis, I project it with the angle, cosine. So this is basically what that says. And the shift that we had this shift, it turns out, what it does is if a walker approaches whatever sink in 1D, if a walker approaches the sink, the shift takes it away. So the walker goes here, the shift is like a force bias. It keeps taking the random walker away from the sink. In 1D, that alone is enough to create this vanishing distribution. In 2D, it tries to do the same thing, this force bias. When you approach the origin, the random walk would approach the origin, this force bias will take it away. But the origin is a singular point. The force bias is not strong enough to create a hole. What you want is a vanishing distribution at the origin. But that can't be done with this force bias alone. So I want to make this random walk into 1D. I want to project it to 1D, and that's what this second step is. Every time it goes off the real axis, I project it. Again, the reason I'm allowed to do that is because in step A, when I do the importance transformation, important sampling transformation, I took the overall phase out of the equation already. So I'm allowed to do a projection. Okay, so that's the algorithm, the two steps. How does this work? So this is the two-electron problem again. What you saw were these two curves, the red curve and then this exact curve, and now the blue curve is what happens now with a new algorithm, okay? And this is, again, a fairly strongly interacting system, even though it's a trivial system. RS10 is fairly strongly interacting, and it works quite well.
So how many auxiliary fields do you have?
This one here doesn't have many. It depends on the basis. It's typically some factor, like 3 times the size of the basis. So this has 19 basis functions, 19 plane waves. That's why we could diagonalize it. You could, in principle, increase this to infinity. But so this would have something like 50 fields. Similarly, this is for 2 silicon atoms. So you have 8 electrons in a FCC supercell. And same sort of thing. This is the circles are free projection. In other words, you just did the random walk without any approximation. That's exact, but it has the phase problem, right? So you see what happens is it comes down and then the fluctuations become huge. And this is the red curve is what happens if you put in this simple constraint that I talked about. And the blue curve is what happens now with the new method. If I cut this piece off, you would see that the blue curve is tracking the free projection with the sine problem, while the red curve deviates from it. Of course, eventually you can't tell anymore with the noise, right? But this part, this portion right here, tells the story. Okay, some comments here. With the discussion, I'm sure you realize this already, but no upper bound, the approximations we make mean that this algorithm is approximate. And there's no upper bound property to it. The method reduces to the constraint path algorithm for something like the Hubbard model, where V is real. Then the projection doesn't kick in, because the projection only happens when you have a phase rotation. So it reduces to the real space case constraint path method, but it fixes the problem for complex phases. The formalism leads to the fixed node diffusion Monte Carlo method. If you force the issue, if you choose a real space basis, it collapses to fixed node diffusion Monte Carlo. So talk about applications now to silicon. We use plane wave basis. We use a Kleinman-Bylander norm conserving non-local pseudo-potential, and this is straightforward to implement, as I suggested earlier, right, because the formalism here is just like a mean field calculation. So it gets rid of the problem with pseudo-potentials in diffusion Monte Carlo. It doesn't have that problem. It has the same setup as a DFT calculation. We do a cutoff that determines the size of the basis, and for these calculations that I'm about to show you, we use up to 10,000 plane waves. That means we have on the order of 100,000 auxiliary fields per time step. The trial wave function is just a single Slater determinant from LDA.
Can I just ask, the pseudo-potential, there's still this open question, should it be Hartree-Fock or LDA-based, because the wave functions are LDA-based? What is the valence exchange correlation, which you completely neglect, I guess.
That's right. So good question. The basis, right, for you to use a pseudo potential, which is basically a one electron thing, in a many body calculation, that's not really checked. That's not established. So it's empirical that it seems to work quite well. The same issue is faced. We basically need to deal with the different energy scales, deal with the core electrons one way or another, right? And we don't have a good way in any quantum Monte Carlo calculation to do that. And this seems to open up the door, to use pseudopotential, just pretending that we could do the one electron pseudopotential, then it allows you to do that. Or if you have a better idea like PAWs or something, this seems to lend itself rather naturally to that also, right? So if you can modify, if you can improve the one electron pseudopotential, then this allows you to use it. But if you are not justified at all to use that, then this is stuck also. Right? This doesn't deal with the many-body effect of the core electrons. Right? Basically, it completely drops that.
But are you introducing Hubbard Stokarovich fields also for the interaction with the core electrons?
No. So it's a pseudo-potential. Core electrons are out. What all you see is the valence electrons and then the pseudo-atom, the pseudo-ion.
So in some sense, you're still doing model calculations. You derive some model for the valence electrons,
yeah,
and then you do quantum modeling.
Well, except sort of these are sort of, I don't know, referred to as more ab initio sort of pseudopotentials, right? So if they're good.
For some systems, you know that covalence plays a role, like in DFT, you consider or take into account covalence.
Yeah.
But I think in a quantum Monte Carlo, you can hardly do that.
I haven't thought about it enough to.
We know that for eigenvalue matters and what that means. Covalence can be very, very important.
That's right. Yeah. So we're aware of that problem. We've stayed away from alkali atoms so far. So that's an issue to think about. Or the other question you had was Hartree-Fock versus LDA pseudopotentials. I don't really know the answer because we haven't used Hartree-Fock pseudopotentials. It's all LDA so far. Pseudopotentials. But diffusion Monte Carlo calculations, most of them use Hartree-Fock.
I would say our experience is that Hartree-Fock is noticeably better, but we have no reason to explain why. It's ill-defined, this step, right?
So far, at the QMC level, people don't seem to find any dramatic differences in terms of these potentials for the systems they've looked at. And admittedly, the systems are fairly limited. I mean, there haven't been many materials that have been looked at with pseudopotentials, quantum Monte Carlo. So the trial wave function is a single Schrödinger determinant from LDA. And here are some results here. So the first table is for the dimer. So the atom and molecule at equilibrium bond length. And we're interested in the binding energy here. So this is LDA, this is the LDA, the LDA calculation that generated the trial wave functions we used. Right? And we get these numbers here with a binding energy of 3.9 or so. And with QMC, we improved these numbers and the binding energy is 3.12 with an error bar 8. The experimental number is 3.2.
Okay.
What geometry? This is equilibrium. Experimental equilibrium, right, yeah. Good, so, and it's putting these in a box, right, putting both the atom and molecule in a box of 19 able, and that translates into about 5,000 plane waves here. Again, these are, I mean, it's just one number out, but you're talking about the answers you're getting out of your calculations are on the order of 200, and you're interested in an accuracy that's here, right, in the, so even with the pseudopotential, this is sort of a non-trivial difference that you're taking. And for the cohesive energy of bulk silicon, we look at 16-atom FCC supercell and 54, again, experimental equilibrium geometry. And LDA here, with an infinite extrapolated bulk cohesive energy of 5 versus the experimental value of 4.62 with an error bar 8. And our calculated number is 4.59. This ought to have a star in here because we have an extrapolation, right? We used the LDA finite size, this number is basically based on the 54 atom number with a finite size correction derived from the LDA calculation, right? So it's not totally self-contained yet, but we've, so this is basically from the preprint, but we've been able to now do K-point sampling, in other words, block boundary conditions, which is another thing that causes difficulties for QMC, because block boundary conditions means you're going to have wave function boundary conditions that involve a phase, right? So that causes difficulties because you go from in diffusion Monte Carlo from a sine problem to a phase problem. But in this case, of course, we don't care. It's a phase factor that gets taken out, right? So we are able to do that and reduce the size effect substantially now. So we could do special K-point sampling now. And diffusion Monte Carlo 99, there's a number here, 4.63, which is excellent agreement also. So we're in good agreement with diffusion Monte Carlo, almost comparable with error bar 3 versus 2. I'm encouraged by this number a great deal because we take a trial wave function that's a straight LDA solution. While these, because of the pseudo-potential issues that I mentioned at the beginning, a DMC calculation of this order of 54 atoms would require a trial wave function that's a Slater determinant times a Jastrow, with the Jastrow having on the order of 60 to 100 parameters. So we're happy we'd be able to sort of reduce the complexity a great deal. This is more an automatic sort of thing. So let me summarize. I've talked about a QMC method to treat extended interactions with auxiliary fields without the sine and phase problem. We deal with this problem with an approximation. We did the first ab initio ground state calculations using this framework, and the results are very promising. I put ab initio in quote because of some of these issues. We use one-electron pseudopotential, and also we, of course, we're approximate. We take an LDA solution, right, to use as a trial wave function. But the calculations on silicon atom dimer in bulk was 54 atoms. That translates just the valence electrons, 216 electrons. The results are in excellent agreement with experiment. They're very, very accurate statistically also. Potentially, this could be a method to systematically go beyond LDA while using much of its existing machinery, including, for example, going to a different basis space and using some of the newer technologies. Obviously, we have lots to do. This is really just a first calculation. Applications, we want to try more strongly correlated systems now and see what sort of quality the approximation would be. In terms of the algorithm, we want to implement calculations of expectation values. I sort of promised you that, but I didn't show you any correlation functions. But that seems straightforward. The quality, the approximation, what the approximation does to the numbers is one issue, but just getting the numbers seems very straightforward now with this formalism. Further improvement to the algorithm, there's these different choices of one particle basis and different pseudopotentials, different Hubbard-Stanovich transformations. All of these affect the answer. So in some sense, you have more unknowns, but maybe there are more opportunities also. One could, in the context of DF dynamical mean field theory, I think it's possible to generalize this to finite T. We've done that for real fields. So most of what I talked about is in this preprint here. Thank you.